Fiscal analysis was approved by the State Office of Budget Management And in November of 2022, by the Coastal Resources Commission, the Division of Coastal Management does not anticipate any increase in expenditures to the regulated public or local and state government because of this action. In addition to comments received today, comments will be accepted until March 20th, 2023.
Does anyone have any questions for Mike? Thank you, Mike. Thank you for clarifying about the notices. We'll be accepting the comments last night, which I forwarded to you. Public hearing is now open. I do have a sign-up sheet which everyone signed up for. Does anyone from the public wish to speak to State Guidelines for Land Use Planning and Coastal Policy Section? That was your opportunity to give us your opinions. Not the public hearing is now closed. Next is a public hearing for Amendments 15A, NCAC 7K, 207, 7H, and 308 Structural Access Way Use Tax. Mike?
Okay, these are proposed amendments, again, for your rules regarding structural access ways. You recall that you amended your rules previously to allow local governments, state, federal government entities to utilize beach mats for public access, particularly enhanced handicapped access. These amendments now also allow private property owners to use beach mats for access ways rather than requiring the access to be elevated on pilings when installed at grade and no excavation or fill is required. The mats can be no wider than 6 feet, and the permanent exemption for structural use access ways will also apply to the use of beach mats. The overall requirements for the use of beach mats for the siting of these and the use standards that are currently in place for elevated access ways will still apply. Additionally, the amendments will also allow government aid entities to provide public access through the use of beach mats seaward of the vegetation line for enhanced handicap access. And by doing that, rather than having to come to you for variance, all they need to do is have a consultation with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Wildlife Resources Commission to talk about any possible siting issues and adverse impacts associated with threatened endangered species. The public comment period closes on March 20th.
Questions for Mike about this policy? If not, public hearing is now open. We have one signing, Rhonda Kelly.
Microphone what he just said, and from my clients that could not be here today because of their disabilities. So, currently, as you all know, just a real quick reminder, with the American Disabilities Act as well as Fair Housing Laws, all that has to do with structures. It does, and while the Fair Housing Laws have to do with private property and the American Disabilities Act have to do with structures in the public realm, we're not seeing a blend of that yet in beachfront property. So I have clients who really want to own beachfront properties and access them. They do enjoy using beach wheelchairs, but they require them in person. And so that's the limitation, is they're not able to go there on their own independently or with their children and their family. And so they're asking for that special request, obviously, to take care of the coast as well. They're not wanting to harm any kind of vegetation, dunes, wildlife, that sort of thing, but still also have access. Currently, as you know, there is nothing on record for private property, so that's why we're excited today to be able to talk about that and give them that opportunity. From my clients themselves, they just asked me to read that their words, which is, they'd like you to know that beach wheelchairs are great, but they cannot use them independently. They want to take their children to the ocean from their beachfront home. Most beaches don't allow ATVs on the beach, except for lifeguards. So if for some reason there was some sort of limitation on certain beaches that would not allow a beach mat, they would like the consideration of allowing disability or or people with disabilities or mobility limitations to maybe have golf carts that would allow access with certain beach tires or ATVs if their disability allows for that for them. Just some kind of alternate solution instead of just saying nothing at all if possible. And obviously this is going to matter on which beach we're at as well, because their towns will have certain rules. And they just wanted to reiterate how difficult it is for them and that it's their dream to always at least try. And I told them I'd pass that along. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Does anyone else wish to make comments on this public hearing? Now, this public hearing is now closed. Next, the public hearing for amendments to 15A, ACAC, and the 600, voting structure policies, and 7A, and 208, here's the document. So, Mr.
So, this is a public hearing for your flooding of our system amendments. Just for reference again, flooding of our system are used to grow out shellfish, and so they to protect them from predation until they can survive for a while. The proposed rule amendments are 7N603, which will add flooding outboards to the flooding structure policy. Then allow that, then be allowed at a permitted marina or private docking facility. And the amendments are also 7H208B6B, which would then consider flooding outboards as a platform, which will be part of your platform square footage calculation for shading impacts. OSBM has approved the fiscal analysis, and there's no significant fiscal impact.
Thank you. Questions for Daniel? Thank you, Daniel. Public hearing is open. We have a lot of people signed up to speak. Three people asked to speak. Keith Larry from Holly Springs.
Thanks for allowing me to speak today. My name is Keith Larrick with the North Carolina Farm Bureau Federation. And I'm here today on behalf of the Farm Bureau to speak in opposition to the proposed rules for floating upweller systems or FLUPSIs. We feel that oyster farming clearly falls under the definition of agriculture in General Statute 106-581, and as a result should be exempt from the development definition in the Coastal Area Management Act. The farming equipment that we're discussing today is used solely for shellfish production and should not fall under regulation by the CRC and DCMs. I mean, it's not just Farm Bureau that feels this way. DEQ itself, through the Division of Marine Fisheries, permits oyster farms as agriculture by issuing an aquaculture operation permit on top of their leasing process. All of the equipment used to grow oysters is permitted through that aquaculture operation permit. On top of the legality issue, logistically, it just doesn't make sense for two divisions in DEQ to issue permits for the same operation. I'd like to cover a few facts about FLUPSIs and how big of a footprint we're talking about. A typical FLUPSI is 20 feet by 8 feet. That's 160 square feet. So even if the oyster industry has a large expansion, the overall footprint of these FLUPSIs in the environment is really going to be minuscule. These FLUPSIs have to be located in calm water, and they're going to be deployed either on existing docks or inside an oyster lease. They're not going to be out in navigable areas. So we feel like the chance of conflicting uses with these is minimal. FLUPSIs have become kind of the industry standard equipment for oyster nursery stock, and they serve no purpose except for producing an agricultural product. But by regulating them to the point of, where it's burdensome or out of existence, that will put our oyster farmers at an economic disadvantage compared to other states. I would say the proposed rules don't state which type of CAMA permit would be issued. We do know one oyster grower has attempted to get a FLUPSI permitted, and they were told it would be a CAMA major permit. Feel like that's pretty burdensome considering that most docks themselves receive minor permits. I would close by saying oyster growers are open to some reasonable regulations, but we feel like those should be implemented by DMF, either through their lease or an operating permit. So our ask would be for CRC to abandon this rulemaking action, or secondarily to at least put it on pause while we work with DMF and DEQ to maybe incorporate some appropriate requirements into their already existing permitting program. So, in closing, thanks.
Thank you very much. Dave Green signed up. You still not want to make any comments?
I do not want to make comments that have already been made. Thank you.
Jay Starvin.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak on this matter. My name is Jay Styron. I own the Carolina Mariculture Company. We grow all bottom shellfish. We were one of the first ones in the state to start with this floating structures. We don't have a flopsy, but we do support the industry, and this is one of the aspects of the industry we need to grow. The state has spent a lot of money, time, and effort to get an oyster industry started in the state. As a coastal resident, a lot of people know how important oysters are for the area, environmentally, economically, socioeconomically. And this, we see, as just another piece of our equipment. As Mr. Laird said, we go through a lot of the permitting process with DMF already. And up until now, DMF has handled every piece of equipment we've had. We have not had to go to Canada for any permits. So we don't see how this has now all of a sudden become a structure. And when I looked, after hearing about the oyster farm that wanted to get one and was asked to have a major permit, when I looked at major permit rules, the activities require projects for more than 20 acres of construction or covering more than 60,000 square feet or have environmental consequences. And these flopsies have none of these. So again, I can't see how we're being forced into that direction. Again, something Mr. Laird also was alluding to, these flopsies are basically huge filters. The small shellfish are in there, water is pumped up through the bottom, they're filter feeders. So actually the water coming out of these are cleaner than the water that was going in there. So that's another environmental benefit. And then the 300-pound gorilla in the room for me is duck blinds. Duck blinds are ubiquitous up and down this coast. They are not regulated in one manner at all as far as the structure itself. As far as I can tell, only three counties in the whole state even require permits for a duck blind, and they're not attached to camera. I could go put a duck blind out with 6-inch pilings, 8-inch pilings, make it 20 by 20, 40 by 40, in navigable waters, and not be required a camera permit. So we are asking for equal application under the law. If one is a structure, the other is a structure. And I don't see how we can find a way out of that using logic. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair and members of the commission. Before I get started, I want to kind of take a moment and say that. So the public hearings and the workshops that I've done in the past, there have been times when I've seen people's faces and they've obviously said, man, you need to get your head checked. So I did that back in August. Turned out I had a brain tumor, had surgery to remove that. Took me out of work a little bit. So I've got a couple of parameters, facial weakness on the right side, and can't hear out of my right ear. So more than anybody in this room, I'm very anxious to see how well I do. So hopefully y'all will be fine. And I want to thank staff for the support and all the positive thoughts and prayers and everything while I was out. So thank you.
Before you get started, you're better. Whoever's got the phone, shut it off.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Working on it.
So the amendments that you'll be looking at today are in your ocean hazard area rules for 306, 3309, and 3310. The rules that we're talking about today are they fall under your ocean hazard area, areas of environmental concern. And within the ocean hazard area of environmental concern, there are four ADCs within that. There's the ocean erodible, which that's typically on the ocean front, where we have ocean front setbacks. Those have been in place, and they're updated approximately every 5 years, but they've been in place since 1979. The one thing to note about the ocean erodible area is that it is not mapped because it's measured from the first line of stable natural vegetation, so you'll never see it on the map. So if you map it today, you get a storm overnight, erosion causes the vegetation to move more landward, that changes the land boundary. So that boundary is out there, it's just not on a map. Then there's the new favorite, the MO hazard area. The current boundary has been in place since 1979. It is a static boundary, and as you know, it's while we're here, and this morning talking about ADCs. The third is the State Fork Inlet Management Area. And we have two of those, one's at Cape Fear and one's at Beaufort Inlet. And most may not recall that those two boundaries actually started out as MO hazard area boundaries in the 2010 proposal to the Commission from the Science Panel. And the last one is the undedicated beach area of environmental concern. This is a temporary ADC designated by the Commission when a storm comes through and wipes out the vegetation, whether it covers it up or erodes it. It's just that you establish a temporary measurement line for most major setbacks. So I wanted to remind everyone of these ADCs because regardless of the ADC, you're still within the ocean hazard area of environmental concern. So it doesn't matter which one you're in, you're still under that main key umbrella within those. Within these ADCs, there are no build zones. You can't build in any of these ADCs. The Commission has rules that apply to these. Now, kind of going through the ones we're putting amendments in today. But within these, there are no build zones. Setbacks that are applied, typically when you're told that you can't build something, it may be tied to the actual setback. And they've been setbacks updated every 5 years and have been since 1979. And one thing to mention about ADCs too is that within those, there are processes or criteria that influence change in those areas. And so what the Commission has tried to do is say, all right, on the ocean front, you have ocean front forces that are kind of influencing those areas. In the inlets, you have inlet-related processes that are influencing those, whether it's man-made through dredging or terminal growing. There's other influences there. And with the state port, you've got dredging that has some influence. You know, with the inlet or the unvegetated beach, you just have storm recovery. So some of the questions and concerns that we got came right after the September of last year when the Commission adopted the boundaries and the rules, and staff, staff asked the Commission to pull those back to look at some additional amendments. So one of the concerns was, you know, looking at the grandfathering and does it apply in the general hazard area. You may recall that in the previous version, and I'll show you a different version today, where the grandfathering language appeared in 0306 and in 0309. So I'll show you the change there. There were some questions around that. The existing small structure exception in 0309, when you adopted or approved or adopted the rules in September, The staff got some questions about, can that be applied inside a criminal hazard area? And also one of the key differences here that I want to point out is that this rule applies to lots that were created before June 1st. So if you cannot meet your current setback that's in place today, if you can meet the minimum setback of 60 feet, then you can do the small structure exception, which is 2,000 square foot, as long as you meet the conditions of the rule, the additional conditions. The other thing was in the 07H-0104, and that rule was repealed. That applies to lots created after June 1 of 1979. Again, it wasn't an exception, but it applied to lots that couldn't meet the current setback, but it allowed for a small structure that was no greater than 2,000 square feet. And again, you know, for the question about do these rules apply inside of criminal hazard area? So the first one I want to kind of talk about where the amendments occur is in 0306A3L. This is current existing grandfathering rules. And with the beach plan rules that the commission adopted and they went into effect back in August, this rule applies to structures that were built prior to August 11, 2009, or in any of the community that has a beach plan or an approved and still a current statutory exception. So the changes that are being amended here is that we had to point to the erosion rate setbacks. So it changed from 5 to 3, so that's just a change to reference the erosion rate setbacks. But then we added the last three lines on the bottom there. And so what that does, it just points to it and says, all right, if you can't meet the provisions in 0306, you can go to 0309 to apply the small structure exception, which will allow you to meet the minimum setback of just 60 feet. And so this is just a rough thought. You can't meet this grandfather, you can't meet the setback rules, then maybe 0309 could be utilized, but it just refers folks to that. So it doesn't change the meaning of the rule. This is, you could use this as an alternative if you can't meet the conditions here. And so here I also underline the date. So this, as it reads, for structure built after the August 11, 2009, so when I show you 0309 amendments in a minute, it may be not necessary to include that date because it applies to all lots and structures, not whether you're before or after this date. So it may be that just the date needs to be taken out of this proposal. So I just underlined it in red just so you can kind of see it as a marker so we can come back to it. So if we look at 07H309, this is the small structure exception. So this before applied to lots that were in place prior to essentially the camera rules and the commission's rules. And so that's the significance of that 1979 date. So since 104 was repealed, it applied to lots after that date. SAF is proposing that essentially we take the 1979 date out and that this would apply to all properties. It says, all right, you can't meet the current setback, but you can meet that minimum setback of 60 feet, and you can meet these conditions in this rule and build a structure no greater than 2,000 square feet. I kind of pause for a minute because that's kind of significant, because right now this only applies to structures that were built prior to that 1979 date, but when 104 was in place, there were some subtle differences there, but you could still build a structure no greater than 2,000 square feet if you had to meet those conditions of 104, which was the primary one there was, you can't meet the setback today, but you can meet the setback that was in place at the time the lot was platted. Then you could use that small structure exception. So this is kind of a blend of what old 104 was and the current 0309B. So how this rule would be applied is that you can't meet the current setback, but you can meet the minimum 60 feet setback, and you could build a structure no greater than 2,000 square feet and no more oceanward than your landmost adjacent neighbor. And there's other conditions in that rule, but essentially that's what this will allow. And I underlined the last piece there. One of the other differences between 104 and 0309 is that
0309 currently limits the footprint to 1,000 square feet. 104 just limited you to 2,000 square foot, so it didn't give you any guidance on the footprint, just that overall floor area. So underline that last sentence. So if we take out the condition on the footprint, there's no need to include that this would, is what would be included in the footprint. Does that make sense? So if we strike through, you're not limited to 1,000 square foot, that last sentence just simply says, all right, this is what a footprint should be considered. You know, it's covered deck, the main structure. So if we take out the footprint there, then there's no need to retain what's defining a footprint. Does that make sense? So anyway, I underline that saying that the commission accepts that and it's probably worth considering. Do we also strike out that last sentence to not define what the footprint is in the application of this footprint? Lastly, in your MLAT area use standards, the version that the commission adopted back in September had grandfathering language that was just a copy paste from the 0306 grandfathering. Rather than have it in two places in the rules, this simply refers you to 0306. So if you look at your MLAT area rules, you can have this point you to that grandfathering language. Because one of the concerns that folks had is that, all right, in an inland hazard area, new construction is limited to 5,000 square feet. That's an existing rule that's been in place for decades, so it's not a new rule. It just applies to inland hazard areas. But if you're now inside the inland hazard area, you have a structure that's greater than 5,000 square feet, then can you rebuild? The answer is yes, but you've got to meet the conditions in the grandfathering rules. And the grandfathering rules, they're current rules. Nothing new, nothing's changing there in how the grandfathering rules are applied. So to get some of those questions, grandfathering absolutely applies to inland hazard areas. In fact, it applies to all ABCs. The small structure exception in 0309, that applies to all ABCs except for the unvegetated beach. So what is the difference between being in an ocean erodible area versus an inland hazard area? So if we look at existing rules today, again, new construction is limited to 5,000 square feet. So if you needed to build as a result of storm damage, in the grandfathering rules, you can meet those conditions, you can certainly rebuild. If you can meet setbacks, you can rebuild. But it's just new construction. I've got a vacant lot, or I want to do a tear down and just rebuild, you would just be limited to 5,000 square feet. That's existing rules. Existing rules, you're only limited to one unit per 15,000 square foot of land area. This doesn't say you have to have a certain size lot built. It just says if you have a lot that's under 15,000 square feet, you can only build one structure there. And that's current rules. But the amendments, we're not making a distinction between commercial and residential. It's just every structure, if you have a lot that's less than that, it's one unit per 15,000 square foot land area. So the big difference between being in an ocean erodible area on the ocean front is that we're going to apply inland erosion rate setbacks, not the adjacent ocean front setback factors. That's how current rules are applied, is you're taking that adjacent rate and carrying that through to the inland. So that's the difference. We're inland erosion rates versus taking the ocean front adjacent rate and applying it. And then obviously it's the updated map boundaries. That's the two differences is number three and number four is the real difference, because you've got the existing rules that are just carrying forward with the new boundaries. So as Braxton mentioned earlier, staff at OSBM are recognizing that, yes, there's potential to meet that fiscal substantial impact. And so what we have to do is provide two alternatives in fiscal analysis. So number one, and the staff, and we're looking for commission feedback on this, number one is kind of the route the commission is taking right now, is updating boundaries and doing the rule amendments to accompany those boundaries.
alternative two is updated boundaries, but essentially no rule change. And what that would mean is you would have the boundaries, but continuing to pull the adjacent oceanfront rate and applying that to the inlets. And the problem there is that because the boundaries do extend a little bit farther down the beach, you're most likely going to pick up a minimal erosion rate, which would then be applied to the inlets. Number three is no updated boundaries or no updated rule amendments. Continue using the existing boundaries, which is the 1979 boundary, and just continue with the rules that the commission has in place right now. So today, what staff are asking is for the commission to consider the additional amendments to 0306, 0309, 0310. And this doesn't mean those rules go into effect soon to follow after this. It just means we can now proceed with, when we update the fiscal, we can now apply these amendments and then take those out to public hearing and continue with the rulemaking process. So I'll be happy to take any questions.
Did he answer your question about bank grandfathering? He asked me a question about grandfathering. Did that answer your question?
I do have a question, though. So basically, you're going to re-look at the fiscal analysis, like you asking us to take which of those three to do it.
Well, or if you have any other ideas, right now this is staff, we kind of did a brainstorm, and obviously the alternative one is kind of the direction that staff is in the commission pursuing, but we have to, when we do this, say, all right, fiscal impact can be a cost or a benefit that exceeds $1 million over the course of 12 months. So whether, it's, like I said, if it's a loss or a cost or it's a benefit, if it exceeds that $1 million, then we have to do two alternatives. And so if the commission has any ideas or you support alternative two and three, right now this staff proposing that we can look at another option to fit alternative two or three. Two is what's required, so we don't necessarily need a fourth one, just.
And I had a question on the grandfathering rules that are under on the bill 5-8. What does work at to make that determination?
It's true. So the August 11th, 2009, is that what you're asking?
That one, or there was another earlier?
All right, so the 1979 date, flashback to that one. So that's if you had a lot and you bought it before the commission had rules in place requiring setbacks. This is giving you the benefit of saying, all right, we now have setbacks, and we're just asking you to meet that minimum, but in trade, you're just, you have to keep that structure size to a 2,000 square foot floor area. So it's giving you an allowance of building something, but you only have to meet the 60-foot setback, not, so if you had an erosion rate that was 5, so instead of doing 5 times 30 to get your setback, it would simply be 6 or 30 times.
Yeah, I guess my question was, if somebody bought a property, maybe an older property, and had to do something to get a permit for it, how would they go about establishing that they
I'll assume just that the county tax office give it to when the lot was created.
You don't have to have a certificate of occupancy or a building permit there or anything like that.
Not that I'm aware of.
Ken, would you go back to the fiscal analysis slide? I got lost. There would be a fiscal analysis rule as proposed, correct?
Right, so we'll go through some updates and things in that fiscal. But because staff is saying, all right, yes, there's that potential that you can exceed that $1 billion threshold within a 12-month period.
So alternative one could exceed.
Could exceed, so yes. Even if we said, all right, we're acknowledging that, but we can't pin a dollar amount to it, we still have to come up with two alternatives.
When you go the route of a substantial economic impact, it requires that you consider two two other alternatives. So as part of the fiscal impact, we will analyze both the rules that we're talking about now, which is the agency preferred rules, and we'll consider a second one, which would be the null alternative, basically to leave the rules as they are. And then the third alternative is, which is kind of a combination of the two, where we continue to use the adjacent OEA erosion rate in the hazard area, like we have been in the old rules. And then the we don't need rule language for the other two alternatives, but we need to discuss the pros and cons of each and why we're choosing one over another.
But you only need the alternative, the two additional alternatives, if you exceed $1 million.
Yeah, because we're saying that there is a substantial economic impact,
right,
of $1 million in a 12-month period.
Okay.
Jackson.
Okay.
Thank you. Want to go back to Commissioner Smith's question. The 2 dates you brought up. So the 79 date is. The lot had to have been platted by that date, and I don't know exactly how you looked that up, but it can be determined through
the registered deeds. The registered deeds,
registered deeds and that kind of thing. So that's. But we're proposing to take that out in the rule change, and then August 11th, 2009. That was actually established in statute, but the legislature stepped in and said, for any houses that were already existing by that date, because that's when some of our graduated setbacks came into effect in the CRC rules. So the General Assembly established that date for grandfathering. What we've done since is said, well, if you have a beach management plan approved by the commission, then you could have those same provisions apply after 2009. So it's kind of the General Assembly was providing more flexibility, just provide even more if you have a plan in place.
Establishing those dates and all of the automatic, I know the commission was recently challenged for the numbers as well.
Makes it very confusing.
Yeah, that 2009 grandfather date was established by general statute. Can we just ignore that?
I don't know if you can or not. If you do that, you're just. Taking away one of the incentives of the beach management plan. That would just make that
out. I add to my comment. Of course, you don't ignore the General Assembly, but there might be situations that don't fit all the parameters, so then that wouldn't apply. And I think that's what Brad's been saying, but I just think that would be promising stuff. That's not good.
Suggesting this, but it looks like another potential variation of this would be no updated inlet hazard area boundaries with the rule amendments. Would that make any sense if you kept the boundaries as is and didn't use the rule amendments? It's basically a slight variation of alternative 3. I'm just wondering if that would make any sense.
That's just something we've got to prepare to see. Off the top of your head, I'm trying
to. Would that blend, basically?
Well, I can completely see where you're coming from and why you're thinking that. I think the main thing there is just that we're trying to look at this from a realistic alternative. We're not trying to throw something out there that would not make any sense. And
right.
Just as a straw man. And in this case, the older IHA boundaries are pretty far out of alignment with the inlets and the areas that you're trying to regulate. So I think the problem with that would just be, by not updating the maps at all, you're really kind of propagating an issue we have currently.
So it wouldn't make sense to have rule amendments with the current boundaries.
That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah, I think not.
Right.
So staff is asking for direction. Their staff's preferred alternative is one, which is where we've been heading through commission discussions and directions with the given staff. And they're asking for two more in order to include
direction to pursue the what's been presented. Alternative one is preferred, and the other two is the options.
How is what's the function of the analysis done for alternative two? For what are we creating a multiple choice for somebody to pick? And what's the
As I said, it's that having two alternatives is what's required by the ADA. We would develop this fiscal consultation with OSBM. Basically, you're showing that you've considered two alternatives and not changing the rules at all, plus something else. They don't require you to come up with something completely different as an alternative. So when we come back to you, this will have run through OSBM before you see it. I know a lot of our fiscal analysis for a conditional approval pending that review, but because it's a substantial economic impact, it needs to go through OSBM first.
Okay, so the outcome is going to be alternative one will have less impact, alternative two will have less impact, and alternative three will have no impact.
Well, not necessarily less, but there'll be
impact. It might endorse a positive impact or something. Why? Why are we doing this?
What's it going to
be used for? I think
it's supposed to give the idea is to give the public an idea of what you would consider if that didn't go through. Like it's supposed to be a transparency thing so that they can see the other options around it and like make a more informed comment.
So we still have to get to the end final point. Who would be affected by those two? So we can't just say it in a paragraph. We have to still go through and say, all right, this is what you're looking at. Can't be affecting one way or the other.
And we have run these conceptually through OSBM just this week, and they're okay with us going in this direction. If that's where you're sending us.
Since you're at the microphone, get a part, Tina, either one. Can you put me in context, regardless of what we may or may not approve on this point, as far as the physical analysis, where is that the step of the rules going forward in the future?
Well, that's the physical analysis, just like we already you heard us report on previous ones. I'm going to present a fiscal analysis on the planned vegetation rule. It's all part of the APA process and the rulemaking process. So the fiscal and the rule language go together for public hearing.
This is the first time.
So this is all coming before public hearing?
Yes.
In the process? We're going through the public hearing process.
This is part, it hasn't got to public hearing.
Yeah, I just want to relay this as the final.
Could you guys kind of summarize in a nutshell? I'm a pretty simple guy. The changes that you're thinking about or setting before us with grandfathers, if those are all implemented, what does that do? What is the change?
So, as Braxton mentioned before, when the graduated setbacks went into place in 2009, the idea was that property that was built prior to 2009 was not subject to that graduated setback. So, therefore, there may be some larger structures that are closer to the ocean than they should be based on the graduated setback. So, the grandfathering provisions were put in place so that those larger structures would be less restricted if they had to rebuild or in that scenario.
So that's a benefit.
That's a benefit to those who were in place prior to the graduated setback. Okay. Now, with the beach management plan, if you're managing your beach, why not get a benefit from that as well?
Right.
And so that's why we're looking at, all right, built prior to the 2009 date, or you have a CRC-approved beach management plan or an unexpired static non-vegetation
then you can also utilize grandfathering for the area that applies to beach management.
That's another benefit.
And it applies to all EDCs, including Asbury. So if you have an existing structure greater than 5,000, you have to redo it for some reason, you can use it.
And then the additional provision is the 2,000 square foot, the small structure exception, which were, used to be just for pre 79 lots. Now we're saying anybody can do that.
So, again, the key difference with this amendment is that it applies to everybody. So, regardless of your erosion rate, regardless of the AEC, you just have to meet the 60 foot setback, which you can build in larger than a 2,000 square foot structure.
Is the commission
to clarify, so we would come back to the commission with the fiscal analysis in this case because of the changes, and then go to public hearing with both the new updated grandfathering provisions. All of this together would go to public hearing.
Yes, of course. Until a nod from the commission. Consensus is let's move forward.
Any questions?
No? This is a totally unrelated question, but it's a question that I've heard. I know we have public hearings and we have certain ways to ratify, but I heard several people say they didn't get it. They didn't know about it. What is that? What is our current procedure, and do we need to think about a different way to do that?
So the state just requires that we publish, on the state on the website and then in one newspaper, one publication for an area being affected. So what we rely heavily on local government, so that every time those daily newsletters go out to folks who are on the email list, highly encourage town staff or their own CRAC to forward that on to people so that they can get those out to the members of their community. That's the best way to do it. Because right now we're just required to put it in a publication in the local newspaper and on the website.
And in the North Carolina Register.
So you have to kind of stay in tune with that a little bit. But
and often press releases.
Doug happens in any group of property
owner
does not get any
maintenance. And that's a problematic.
Right.
I mean, buying a piece of property that's not in an ocean hazard area today, but it's going to be dramatic. And I'd like for somebody to make a fine deal. That's what I would want.
It is a big deal.
It's a huge deal.
That's where we depend. Our staff depends a lot on local government system, publicized stuff too.
Well, it's not pushed out to the towns per se. We have to look for it.
Right, it comes out to our daily newsletters and that kind of thing. So you just have to just.
Yeah.
Is that a subscription?
One of the things that could happen, and I'm going to throw this out, is our PIO should be pushing stuff out to local governments. That's one of the things. Probably
should happen. Local government's being formed. That is my suggestion. That happened. Madam Chairman, I'm David Hewitt from Holden Beach. I'd caution the CRC to rely on local government to carry out a function that's clearly.
It's clearly an information process. It's another step in the process of informing people. It's not meant to supplant CRC rules or CAMA rules. It's meant to give local citizens another step in the process and ask local governments to inform their citizens as well.
I understand.
Thank you. No one motion or support, but comfortable with consensus pushing staff forward for this. Earl Boone, second.
I'll say.
Section. All in favor? All opposed? Thank you, Ken. And by the way, you did a good job.
This is going to be
better for the time of first.
You did a good job.
We're happy to see you.
Yes, I think thanks.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just was recalling, I believe there is a way to subscribe to DEQ news updates, which would obviously alert the public to any and all things related to upcoming public hearings. Is that also a possibility that we could share that with the communities and people could self-subscribe to that as a way to get notification on
public hearings? I'm happy to follow on all these. Our PIO, Chris, is something about ill this week, so I'll follow up with you on this whole conversation.
Next, that's 15A.
What I have for you today is the next iteration of septic tank rules that we've been discussing over the last couple meetings. I'll just kind of review the issue for you all and then let you know where we're at. I think a new memo and rule language was put at the places yesterday. We've had some more discussion and some more input over the last week. I'll get into that in just a second. But just to review, the whole issue kind of came to light last spring, summer, where there were several house collapses along the National Seashore, the Levante area, resulting in a 15-mile debris field, release of hazardous materials, as well as damaged septic systems that was starting to create a chronic issue out there, and it was brought to our attention. You heard presentations both from Dave Halleck of the National Seashore, as well as Braxton on the house issue, as well as follow up issue that kept presenting itself related to septic systems. And just to recap, you recall we talked about that DHHS, Environmental Health, oversees the county public health departments in issuing the septic tank permits. They require that the septic tanks be 50 feet from mean high water. New systems need to conform with the existing ocean floor setbacks. Previously, DEQ policy treated them repair of these systems, replacing that as repair of these systems under the Canada permitting program. We had recent replacements of septic tanks that were still in harm's way in terms of subject to overwash. And these septic systems were being impacted and blown open in not necessarily severe storms, just moderate wind events. So that's why we started looking at rule language that would address the siting of these systems relative to these areas of the beach where they are continually chronically damaged. So one of the things that has happened since the mail out was we've received input from a number of people, but most notably we got input directly from DHHS on what we were trying to do. So what we're focusing on are the specific discrete structures associated with septic systems. We're looking at the septic tank, pump tank, and the ground absorption system. So rather not worrying so much about any wiring or piping that may be associated with it. Because these are the structures out on the dry sand beach and such that are causing the chronic issues with the repeated damage that they're seeing. So we got this input from DHHS where we're using their suggested language to get at what we're wanting to focus on. Rather than citing their rule language as we had in the past, which was 18A, 1935, you may recall, they pointed us to the general statute language and definitions where these terms are overlapped. So it's a better description of the structures that are being located on the beach that we're wanting to address get at this issue. We're focusing on the replacement and relocation of structures associated with these systems. See where the vegetation lies. We're also looking at it, if you can repair these specific structures in place, then then you don't need a CAMA permit. But if you need to relocate them or replace them entirely, then you've got to come for a CAMA permit, and it's going to be subject to a siting criteria that we have based on the public trust areas where you have your jurisdiction. And I'll get to that in a second. So we're talking about looking at the specific structures and you know, regardless of the what our repair replace criteria is, if you can fix it where it's at, you're good to go. If you need to move it or put a new one in, then it's going to require a CAMA permit. Again, we're just clarifying this here, that new structures, when you build a new house, new septic system, it's got to meet the current setback. That's nothing new in our rules, but we're deciding to clarify that in the existing rules to just for clarity, to be clear. This is something that Bobby Outen brought up in our discussion in front of the CRAC yesterday. This is has to do with whether or not structures on the oceanfront are replaced utilizing public versus private funds. Now, this is a long-standing rule that we've had for you know, quite some time, whereas if particularly for as it pertained to houses, was that if public funds were used to relocate the structure, it had to meet the current setback. And we recently addressed this rule with you, I guess the last year, probably around this time, where houses were being elevated that were well seaward of the vegetation line, you know, utilizing the FEMA money. And
can we clarify one more thing, Mike? When we're talking about public money, we're not talking about insurance proceeds. We're talking about public grants, that type of funds.
Right, that's what we can use. Have been talking about.
I just want to make sure everybody realizes we're not
going
after
anybody's insurance. Right. These are public grants. So we addressed the rules and just clarifying certain things related to the elevation, relocation, and elevation of structures. So now we're applying that same longstanding policy concept to the replacement, relocation of these, you know, specific structures associated with septic systems. If you've got public money to relocate the house or these structures, then it's got to meet the current setback. If you're using your own funds, you've just got to move back as far as possible and relocate the septic system components as well. But with this criteria that I'm going to get into, that it needs to be not within the public trust area of the ocean beaches as defined in General Statute 77-20. And I'll show that in just a minute. And then we're also want to, even though this has been practiced for us and getting structures removed, we want to make it clear to the regulated public that when structures are relocated, the old stuff needs to come out to be taken care of. So 77-20, it describes the public trust areas associated with ocean beaches. Now, the public trust area is the wet sand area subject to regular flooding and the dry sand area subject to occasional flooding by tides. And it's important to note that it doesn't include flooding from hurricanes or tropical storms. This using this definition, we really feel like we get at the issue that was brought up back in, I guess it was November, when there was some concern that we would make some houses unlivable because in the aftermath of a storm where the septic system became damaged and the vegetation line receded to a certain point that, you know, we were saying it couldn't be repaired. In this case, you know, those areas or those situations, it would not apply. So if your septic system is damaged and it's still up on the hill, it's just, you know, the pipes got all knocked askew, what have you, it can be repaired and everything's good to go again. But if it winds up in one of these areas, the public trust areas, then it could not be located. And that would be determined by these natural indicators that are in the statute, which provides recognizes the staff in making this determination. And that is, you know, the area of the first line of stable natural vegetation, the toe of the frontal dunes, or the storm trash line. So if you have to relocate any of these components, and there you would not be able to site them within this public trust area, again, this is where you have clear jurisdiction. And like I said, because of the way it's described, it gives staff fairly clear guidance in terms of making that determination on whether or not the system can be relocated. So, like, to sum it up, like where we're at right now, we're focusing on discrete structures associated with septic systems, the septic tanks, the pump tanks, and ground absorption components. And the ground, that could be the drain field. It could be one of the alternative systems that are situated on top of the surface of the soil, and the treatment is through drainage into the soil. We're utilizing DHHS statutory definitions and language that's supported by their staff to address the conditions that we're most concerned with. We're focusing on the public trust area where you have jurisdiction, which is the wet sand area subject to regular flooding, and the dry sand area subject to occasional flooding by tides. It does not include higher areas of flooding or overwash from tropical storms and hurricanes. We'll utilize natural indicators that are familiar to us, which are the vegetation line, total frontal dunes, and storm trash line. And like I said originally, repair systems in place, if you can fix it where it is, that will be allowed and not require a camera permit. Questions or comments?
If I could, I just want to follow Mike's up with a quick comment that we've received a lot of really helpful comments, public comments on this wall, and the DHHS comments, and then the Outer Banks Association of Realtors, SELC, and CRAC discussion yesterday. There are a number of tweaks based on those comments that we want to go back and do. So just as a starting point, I think it'd be great to go and address a few of those and come back in April, rather than asking you to move this forward today. One of them, I have to admit, I was either being hard-headed or just whatever it was yesterday. I was trying to understand Bobby Alton's point. I don't know if Bobby's still here. I think we are working right now on a work group to try to identify areas, different funding mechanisms out there. There's a variety of federal funding sources out there right now, FEMA and others, and looking at even potential future state resources that could go toward helping willing and voluntary homeowners relocate a house if they're in harm's way out on the beach and there's no other solution coming soon. And so we're just exploring, are there financial assistance opportunities out there? And the policy issue on the private versus public funding thing comes up with, if we're going to spend public money, whether it's a federal grant or state assistance or local government assisting property owners, should they, when they're moving a house, have to meet the setback if they're going to spend that money rather than just moving back a little ways where they're still in harm's way? That's where that comes from. But I think if I'm going to say it right, Bobby, I think the question is, with a septic tank, if there were assistance separately for that, where someone wants to move that up off the beach, we don't want to treat that differently because the whole idea is to get these structures off the beach. So it's starting to dawn on me, and I think that's another good thing to revisit, but I just wanted to cut on that.
I'll just say two things. One, this isn't the Bobby Alton amendment. This was the consensus of the CRAC, so that's what they recommended. And two, yes, we understand. There's no discussion about the rule with public and private funds with regard to moving houses and those things. What we were saying is
we're trying to get these septic tanks off the beach. Let's get them off the beach and try to preserve as much of the status quo to keep it fair among neighbors as we can. That was what the consensus of the group was.
You and I had a little discussion yesterday afternoon about questions that were being asked. Why are septic tanks considered separate structures from the house, or does one can't exist without the other? We had a pretty good analogy for him yesterday.
I forgot what I told you.
Value.
I'm sorry?
Value. It was septic tank move. Yeah. If the value of the house is 50%, that's right. What it was, so, septic tank.
Correct. If we say that we're not going to move, if you can repair in place, we don't have to get a camera permit. To the layperson, that means, okay, I can repair it in place, I'll repair it in place, I won't talk to camera. Question becomes, does the 50% rule apply to that repair to determine whether it's a repair or a replacement? And I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
And that's why there's that caveat in there, notwithstanding 7J0210. Which is the repair-replace rule. We're specifically saying that if you can replace it in situ, I mean, if you can repair it in situ, then you're good to go.
And you don't have to do the 50% rule now, because if you had to do the 50% rule, then you've eliminated the rule, because there's almost no repair that you can do that wasn't 50%, whereas a house, you got lots more value to work with.
I just wanted it brought out.
Yeah.
So people... They're asking the questions, could hear the answer.
Sure.
Questions for Mike? Thank you, Bobby.
You're welcome.
And thank the CRIC for their input as well. Sheila?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike, in the instance where a septic tank cannot be repaired, it has to be moved, and there's a requirement and a permit. I just encourage all that as you're working with DHHS to think about those dual permitting processes, because obviously there's the other permit that has to be obtained for the installation. Think about how to streamline those to the best extent practicable so that the septic tank can be moved and put back into service as quickly as possible.
Took the thought right out of my head on that. But this develops a dual permitting process, and you've got two agencies. There's going to have to be some type of serious coordination, because the DHHS or the Division of Environmental Health has to permit it, but it's even dual. Then there's going to have to be some type of notification back to OAK. In this particular area, there might be a notification to county and say, well, now, before the health department can even do a repair or suggest a recommended repair or we might bring county out to say, well, where are these lines? Because they're not going to be trained nor have the authorization to establish where a primary dune or whatever the setback is going to be on it. So it's one of as you were doing the presentation, I was sitting there thinking, because I've been dealt with DEH quite a bit, I'm just getting them to change their rules that waste treatment systems, rather than a 50-foot setback from the mean high water mark, simply cannot be in a designated chemical, whatever our requirements are. I mean, their rules change. Boy, it would make the duplicity of all this go away quickly. DEH is in the process of changing a lot of their rules right now. Huge rewrite. And y'all had good dialogue with them. That was excellent. Especially to pick up their legal terminology from general statute, their definitions, rather than us getting into conflicting definitions. But I think, to me, it's an option to consider, rather than oceanfront properties, that DEH puts that in as a longer setback and refers back to our rules in whatever our lines of demarcation are. And the other factor that kind of got brought up, which was talking about is that's a huge value issue, especially on waste treatment systems that are, since these are now defined as structures, now waste treatment system is going to be a structure. And I think part of our rule is that structure can't be land where it comes to home.
That's the existing.
Yeah.
That's the existing. That's kind of what we're working with last meeting as well. And now it's, we're going in a slightly different direction with this area that would be located in.
Just want to say that this first came to our attention because there were already the two permits in play. So we were advising the LPO on what permit was needed, because under your rules, any time a septic tank was relocated on site, there's actually specific CRC rule language saying that basically requires a permit, and here's what has to happen. Whereas department policy had been treated being replaced in the same spot as repair, and so there was this confusion already between the two agencies. So we have been having really good conversations with them. I completely agree with your point. And you know, it kind of reminds me of like the noose and tarpam uppers, you know, where you, and so we've evolved a relationship there where you have an MOU where our staff can do the buffer authorizations rather than having both DWR and DCM on site if one's not doing one. And where one is stronger, it defers to that rule. And so I think that's exactly the kind of evolution we're hoping for when we're starting with ours.
And as a, you know, an umbrella permitting agency, we're familiar with, you know, that level of coordination.
I don't know if your staff wants to get into the waste treatment. Literally, quite much.
So is this comfortable staff taking back the comments that we received yesterday and then bring something forward at our April meeting?
See you on the track.
Thank you, Mike, very much. Thank you, Max.
My name is Greg Bodner. I'm the major permits coordinator now for the Division of Coastal Management. That has been in my head for years. It's taken a little while to get that part out. And I'm also the project lead for the division in the e-permitting department, and I'm here to give you an update on our e-permitting initiative. To give you a quick overview of the system components that we have an application portal, and that's associated with our major permits, any modifications, renewals, or transfers that are associated with active major permits and general permits as well. There's also a DCM staff dashboard for major permits and general permits that we use to process the applications. There is a resource agency comment portal, so any of our review agencies will use this application or use this system, this portal, to look at the application, to gather the documentation that they need for their own systems, and also to be able to comment into that, into the system. We also have a complaint portal for outside members of the public to log complaints, to provide any documentation or information needed for a particular complaint. We also have enforcement and compliance associated with this and a dashboard associated with that to process. We also can use this system to go through and utilize public information requests. And we can also, of course, this is all associated with a permit database, kind of categorizing and taking that information, putting it in a database so that it's available to report out on various metrics. To show you kind of what the public portal looks like. This is the portal what an applicant or registered agent would use to get into the system. There is a sign-in register system here. There's knowledge base articles, as you can see up here, that assist the applicants or agents or even our review agencies to go through the system, kind of a click-by-click play to see how to use the system and use that to navigate. There's also some quick links on the other side over here that allows them to get documentation on how to, when they upload documentation in it, how to code it, how to name it, things like that to help put it into the system. So if you're an applicant or if you just go onto this website, there's a couple of different pieces on it. There's and information on to contact your field representative. So this particular part is associated with the GIS layer, where all you end up having to do is just type in an email or type in a physical address, and that will give you the correct and appropriate field rep to be able to contact their contact information, to be able to discuss anything you were interested in doing with the property. There's also that complaint form down here where you're able to log in and register a complaint into the system. And there's also the portion to go ahead and log in so that you can do your application. You can do a general permit or a major permit application, modification, or renewal. If you were a review agency and you log into the system, there would be a final piece there that you would click on, which is your link to go ahead and log into the system and to review any applications and to comment as well. The application portal, the way that we designed it is we tried to design it so that it was intuitive and that it was easier to navigate than our standard static forms. So here's a good point. In the very beginning, when you log in as an applicant, if you have a registered agent, all you simply do is once you've logged into the system and registered and you pick the appropriate application that you wanted to fill out, the major permit, you would go ahead and find your registered agent. If your registered agent is already in the system, you would simply have to type in their name and that option would show up. You would click that that's the individual. If not, you would just simply type in their email address and name and a few information on that. And then there's a question that asks if you'd like them to log, if you'd like them to apply, fill out the application. If that occurs, then simply what happens is the registered agent that you've identified would get an email with a link saying that there is an application available for you to fill out. So the DCM dashboard, when the application is available in our system and we're able to process it, this is what our dashboard looks like. There's some navigation links on the side here that helps you navigate to specific parts of the permit system. There's then all these applications that are available in the system. And what this kind of does is instead of a paper application where you have to thumb through it and try to find a particular information that you're looking for, this system kind of gives it to you at just a few clicks away. So it's a much quicker process for us to gather information and take out what we need. So you can see here just a little bit of information, the status that the application is available. That status is also available to the permit applicant. So if they log into the system and they have multiple applications, that status will show up to them, whether it's pending submittal, whether it's in technical review, whether it's been issued, things like that are available for the applicant to see. The type of permit, the type of permit application it is, and then additional information like their name, address, what the field rep is, things like that is all available here for us at just a few clicks. If you clicked on one of those individual applications, once again, that theme is all that information is available to you where it might be in different parts of a paper application. You can see here there's some information about the applicant, information about the address, there's submitted documents, this is where deed, work plans, riparian notifications are all held, and if there's any of that information needed, that's just a click away. So once again, that information is just available in a one specific location rather than in an application, in a paper, in a file, in the office that you have to go look for. The agencies, once again, also have that portal and that dashboard available, too. So the agencies can upload documentation. They can download documentation from the system. They can do quick comments if they don't have a lot of information that they need to get across to the agencies. They can also, download any of that documentation that's within the system for their own application, for their own database. And then they're also able to then upload that information, and all this is available in a SharePoint system. So it's all available on the cloud and accessible if you have access to the internet. So our current status right now, in January 2023, we rolled out the system to our trusted agents. On the 11th of January, DEQ did a press release for our e-permitting system. And currently, we are accepting major permit applications. And as of this morning, we're actually up to 5. Permit applications in this our system with 7 or 6 actually pending submittal now. We're also testing our tablets that are being used for general permits. So out in the field, our field reps have access to this data through a tablet with cellular data availabilities. And so they can go out in the field, they can gather and collect information, they can upload that information into the system. They have access to that information in the field if they didn't have it already with them. They're able to take pictures, they're able to document, do whatever they need to create the documentation available for a general permit to be able to do that in the field with these tablets. Currently, we're in the process of testing some of these tablets right now. We have 27 of them total that we need to buy, so we're doing our due diligence, making sure that those tablets work, they work as intended, and they're doing well before we end up having to buy those additional 23. We have four that we're testing right now. So we're making sure we're fiscally responsible and doing our due diligence at that point right now. And, of course, right now what we're doing is we're looking at bug fixes and improvements. You know, as the one who kind of helped design this with help with staff, you kind of get blind to some of the things that you don't read. You all automatically kind of understand, well, that's what it should do or that's what you intended it to do. So we're now kind of in that process where we're going out to agents and applicants who don't know this system and don't understand what we are trying to do and getting feedback from them to make the system improve it, make any bug fixes. And overall, there has been, in general, as with anyone doing new things, there's kind of a resistance to it, but a lot of the agents that we've been working for, once they have gotten into the system and looked at it, they feel that it is very intuitive and they're very happy with, overall, the process that we've got going on right now. Some of the system benefits that we have, currently, you know, in the past, we've had that paper application, so you have a dynamic project that has to be fit on static forms, and where do you put those particular things? So we've kind of designed an application now that asks targeted questions based off of your project. So, you know, no longer do you have to put it on a paper form, or no longer do you have to search to find where you need to put your information. As you move through the system, you're asked a series of questions based off of what we refer to as development activities. So if you want to build a bulkhead, it asks you at a certain point, what do you want to build? And you identify what you want to build, and then based off of that, it'll ask you questions. Like if you wanted to build a dock and pier, and it was over 10 slips, then it would ask you additional questions concerning with marinas. Applicants could look at their past and existing applications that are within the system. And they can also, like I said, modify those applications, renew, or transfer those applications online as well. Data is no longer confined to the office in that paper file. It's now available on the cloud with these tablets, and our field representatives are able to take that data in the field with them as well. So, you know, no longer do our field reps have to go back into the office if there's a piece of information that they need that they don't have. If it's in the system, it'll be available to them. And also, one of the biggest things that we've done is we try to speed up the process and create spots where we can, you know, make things quicker and make things more available. So templates and autofill availability in this system have really kind of streamlined this and reduced effort in creating things like memos, letters, agency circulations, and et cetera, to now just a few clicks. Where instead where it took maybe 15 minutes to take a memo template and change all the information in that memo, now it takes the information from the application and the information that we put into the system and it auto-populates that memo. And now you just send that email out with a couple of clicks rather than taking that additional time. So if you have three or four or five memos, letters, and things like that, that time builds up pretty quickly. And then finally, one of the additional things we've done is we've allowed online payment through credit cards. We still have our traditional checks, money orders, things like that they can do also, but we provided just a little bit more customer service and availability of allowing online credit card payments as well. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
How long do you charge a fee?
For the credit cards?
Online driver's license,
$2. Yes. So the department uses an outside system known as Payit to log these and do these online payment systems. And the way that system works is that there's a $3.95 surcharge for any Visa used. If it's a non-Visa card, it's a 2.65% of the transaction. And if you remember when we did the fiscal analysis, looking at The maximum fee that we could charge, which is $475, at that 2.65% for approximately 3,230 actions was a little over $40,000. That's the maximum, because it's the maximum amount of fee that we could charge, and it's probably the most 3,230 permit actions, general permits, major permits, and whatnot a year. We determined that it'll be about a maximum of about $40,657 and some change that would be associated with those transaction fees. And that transaction fee, of course, is just to pay to use their system. It's not brought in by the division or by the department.
Thank you. Questions,
When you said the system is open to the public, is that open to the general public or just to the permit applicant?
Their information for their applications is just open to them. If a public information request or something like that is available, we can use this system to gather the information that they need. There was some concern about opening up all of that information to anyone available, and we prefer to do it through a public information request so that we can provide that information to them in that view, rather than just anybody being able to go online and see an address or a phone number or something like that.
So whoever the applicant was would be assigned a number or an entry number to get into this?
Yes, so they would have a username and password, and then any of the applications that they started or did are available, even if they've been issued or whatnot, all of that information is still available to them.
Great work.
That was one of our big goals, is trying to make this not only easier for them, but easier on staff as well, so that there's more time available to do all the things we never had time to do.
When you go to the field, you say, darn it, I forgot the map.
Yep.
Back to the office you go.
Yeah, as long as you have cellular data and it's in the system, they'll have access to it.
Just say, over my years at BCM, I've often seen permit coordinators and field reps helping folks through permit applications. So not everybody has a consultant or agent. Some people are brand new to the area or new to camera, and I see that. They sit down in the office and actually walk them through how to fill it out. So the same thing goes for this. As people are working with us, some people are more computer savvy than others, and they may have trouble with the system at first, but we plan to walk them right through it. So for those folks that are doing simple projects that just need a little assistance, we'll do that in person.
This will be for all permits or just major?
It'll be major permits and all of their modifications and all in general permits right now. No minor permits, but there is, of course, enforcement compliance and things like that associated with this as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Action items. Consideration of approval of fiscal analysis, 15A, 7A, 15B, 5, 55,
subject to waves, tides, and storms, and the more stable upland areas. DCM staff and LPOs use this line based on visual observation of plant composition and density. And planted vegetation on the oceanfront is considered stable when it has continuous rhizomes beneath the surface. They're mature plants, and there's been recruitment of additional native species, and then also that the rhizomes have a density similar to adjacent areas of the site in question. Now, the vision has always encouraged planting of vegetation to stabilize dunes and such, but some property owners have been of late attempting to reestablish vegetation for a more favorable setback determination through aggressive watering and fertilizing. And it's created questions for DCF staff and LPOs as when is it appropriate to start to look at it, this planted vegetation, for making the stable and natural calls. But anecdotally, staff has found that it typically takes 16 to 18 months before we're starting to see that it meets that criteria. And this is a time frame, if you recall from the previous presentations, we reached out to local experts in planting dune vegetation that they agree that two growing seasons is what it takes to get to that point where it can be considered stable and natural. As far as physical analysis, it's been reviewed by MOQ and it's currently with OSBM, but I've had conversations with them and they're fine with going in the direction that I've got it here. Staff pretty much has typically received anywhere from 20 to 80 requests per year to make stable vegetation calls. Often this is like multiple requests at the same property, something two, three times to the same property. The average time that staff spends making this determination is about 30 minutes, not counting travel time. So at a minimum, having a rule that we're not going to look at it until the second growing season is going to provide some predictability for property owners. It'll decrease staff and local, DCM staff and local staff time. It's going to decrease the workload by about a third. There'll be a potential benefit to the public by avoiding improperly sited development because we're making that determination too soon, which could reduce public expenditures in the case of storms. A couple of variables that we had considered were the storm frequency and severity. Could it impact how long it actually takes? But we expect it to save mostly. It's going to save staff time rather than 10 to 40 hours making these determinations. We reduced about 4 to 10 hours making these determinations. It's not going to change any permit fees for us, so have no impact on DOT. And like I said, the main benefit to the public, to private property owner, is going to be the clear expectations and predictability of when we will come out and be able to say, yes, we can make that first line call now. So staff recommend you approve the fiscal analysis next up at the public hearing.
Any questions for Mike at this time? If not, does anyone wish to make a motion to conditionally approve the fiscal analysis for 7-H-03 at the public hearing?
I'll make that motion.
Second. Any further discussion? All in favor? All opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Next item up for the community.
I do. So, since the time I provided the legal update to you in the packet of materials that went out, there have been some changes. The second item on the first page, which has to do with the North Carolina Court of Appeals case of the petitioner and appellate in Henry Farmville versus the CRC, has been set for an oral argument, and that is going to take place at North Carolina Central University Law School. And the Court of Appeals does this periodically. They hold their hearings all over, or the oral arguments all around the state, so that both communities and law students at different law schools can have an opportunity to watch the Court of Appeals work. So this is going to be 1 p.m. at NC Central Law School in Durham, and I invite members of the commission to come and watch the argument. I'll be arguing on behalf of the commission, defending the chair's decision to deny the request for a third-party hearing that's untimely, which was upheld at the Superior Court level. And I expect that Attorney Brady Richardson will be
appearing on behalf of the appellant, Henry Fonda. So I've asked Renee and Sheila, because I know they're from Chapel Hill. Any commissioner from Chapel Hill is welcome and would be greatly appreciated if you would come. The reason for that, of course, is the Court of Appeals are people, just like we are. And I'm on there as an attorney from the North Carolina Department saying, my commission really cares about that, this issue, this argument, and nobody's there. That's not going to really register with them. You can be assured that the petitioner from Virginia, Alexandria, is going to come down and listen to his attorney argue, and I really appreciate the time that any of you might take to come to that hearing. If you're interested, just email me and I'll get you the directions and stuff like that. And one of the reasons, too, is I often have staff members there for these arguments, but there's a conflict with the annual meeting of the Coastal States Organization up in D.C., so I don't expect staff will be able to participate because they're going to be focused on other things that are very important to DCM. So, anyway, that's that one, and that's new. We just got that oral argument date earlier this week. Then, moving to the second page of the legal updates, the petition for judicial review that was filed by the Clifton group of petitioners in Carteret County Superior Court. They filed it. They said we're just a placeholder. We're working out our disagreement with the permit holder. And these two were third parties who wanted to challenge a permit that had been issued. I just checked in with the attorney, and the case has not settled yet. And the petition has still stayed, and we'll have notice before they come back and decide if they're going to challenge the chair's decisions and not a third-party hearing request. But I just wanted to let you know it's not quite over yet, even though they had told me, it's just a matter of the paperwork. So we'll continue to monitor that very closely. And then the last thing on the legal update was the third-party hearing request that the chair had considered from David Whitaker, which was the last third-party hearing request in 2022, has now passed the 30-day time period by which you can appeal. So the bottom line is, out of the 18, and I don't know if you guys scrolled all the way to the end of the legal update, but I kind of gave you a summary of all the different numbers. So this is on page 32 of the handout I provided you. We had 18 third-party hearing requests filed in 2022 that involved 17 permits in 8 of the 20 coastal counties. Of those, 18, 14 were denied, 0 were granted, and 4 were withdrawn. And I need to take a minute and explain to the commissioners, as you probably know, but I want to make sure you do, that your staff at DCM spends a lot of time with parties in the field explaining to them how our rules work. And the third-party hearing request process is a very simple, easy process. It's a 2-page form they can download from our website and just give us their take on 3 questions. Boom, they've filed it. They can have their day in court. They can have somebody consider the things that are really bothering them about this permit. So they get filed very often. We had 18 last year. That's more than 1 a month. And it takes quite a bit of your chair's time to evaluate those and to make a decision, quite a bit of the staff's time to prepare the staff recommendation. And the fact that 4 were withdrawn after being filed, I think, is just proof of the fact that there's a lot of communication and a lot of teaching and a lot of education going on by DCM staff. And by Christie, your counsel at DCM, as she explains, once they file the, you know, what is it really about? And if they don't have any rule that they think has been violated by the permit, well, that's kind of an important factor to include in a third-party hearing request. So that actually happened a couple of times this past year, and after that was explained that you have to have a reason, not just I don't like it or it's in my view. You know, you have to show why there's a violation of our rule. And that often, that teaching sometimes happens after the fact. So I was very pleased that we only had the 1 petition for judicial review filed out of those 18, and that's the one that's on stay right now in Carteret County.
So what I take away from this is your third-party hearing process really works. I know, you know, we've all been talking and thinking about this, but if we didn't have this third-party hearing process, if the chair wasn't serving as a gatekeeper to evaluate if there's a valid claim, if there's something that really needs to be looked at, and sometimes there is. Is there an impact to navigation? Was notice appropriately received? Those kinds of things have a tendency to kind of need to be fleshed out sometimes. But in other instances, the chair spends the time to figure out that this is really a frivolous case. We don't want to waste OAH's time. And the Office of Administrative Hearing, the contested case hearing process, actually takes a lot of your attorney's time as well. So I was there on 18 separate cases as opposed to these third-party hearing requests. That would probably take a couple of days in court. It would take months to prepare as you go through discovery, and so this process has really been working well, in my opinion. So as you scroll down to the last summary, you see the variance request. We didn't have that many in 2022. I think we had 6 filed and 1 holdover from 2021. So out of the 7 we had, 1 was denied, not counting the ones that you heard today, which included one from 2022. 3 were granted with conditions, so I guess including the one today. 1 was granted, that would be Carolina Beach, without conditions, and 2 didn't proceed. And once again, that can be either because somebody chose not to do the project, or they were talking with staff and they came up with a different project. We don't always know why people don't proceed, but the process has taken a lot of your time at each meeting, but it's been a good way to give people relief from our rules if they meet the criteria. So does anybody have any questions for me on the legal update?
Consideration of resolution for stakeholder engagement for collaborative coastal habitat. I see Jimmy's in the back. Bob, I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. In your materials, was included the resolution I'm going to talk about. This is a resolution that has gone to all of the environmental commissions, and as I think I just heard from Jimmy, that Marine Fisheries unanimously voted to endorse this yesterday. So, I mean, I'd like to, I think, start out by making a motion that we endorse it, and I'd like to speak to that motion if I could.
The Chairman has made a motion to adopt this resolution. Ms. Allen has seconded. Now discussion, Bob.
Okay. One of the things called for in the recent update of the Coastal Habitat Protection Plan was more stakeholder involvement and engagement. I think stakeholder engagement helps us implement the CHIP, and to some extent it also helps us, it helps with accountability, make sure that progress is being made. The CHIP called for voluntary measures to help landowners reduce the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that's getting into the water. And at a meeting late last year in New Bern, a water quality summit that was organized by the Coastal Federation, a number of coastal stakeholders were there. And there was a discussion about the role best management practices can play in reducing nitrogen and phosphorus, as well as how effective cost share programs are at getting landowners to implement best management practices. And we also heard that many of these cost share programs are not as effective as it could be because of the lack of funding. So the resolution calls for the state to use both one-time and recurring funding to more fully fund these cost-share programs that do provide landowners an incentive to implement BMPs. And just on a personal note, from a long career out on the land, I do know that BMPs work and that cost share systems help landowners implement those BMPs, and it really makes landowners part of the solution to our water quality problem. So that's the reason for the motion. Second, and I appreciate the opportunity to put it in front of the commission.
Yeah,
I served with Bob on the subcommittee too, from the CRC to the Coastal Habitat Protection Plan, and there's really getting to be a lot of more lead, I think, to the Coastal Habitat Protection Plan through Jimmy Johnson's guidance. But it is a collaboration of a lot of different agencies and collaborative agencies to try to better utilize in a more efficient way all these funding resources. And this resolution is really trying to target the smaller projects that are equally valuable, whereas before it had to be a fairly major project to be able to get any kind of matching funds. These projects, a lot of times, they aren't cheap to do. I would endorse this resolution.
Any questions for Bob?
Which agency would the additional funding go to, or is that being addressed for the potential legislation?
Most of the people that we heard from were from extension and agriculture, if I recall correctly. Somebody else, Todd, you nodded your head. Yeah. I think that's right.
There is a... I mean, the resolution is written broadly for both urban and rural areas because
right.
there is a cost share program for the built landscape as well. So.
And is the North Carolina Department of Agriculture
yeah.
receptive?
I believe they are, and the gentleman that was here from the Farm Bureau earlier helped put this resolution together.
Excellent. Thank you.
Any other questions? I think it's a little bit better. The more efforts we can get for the weather than the rest of the field is just not the weather. Different projects, new DMPs especially. So. Anything else? All in favor of the motion? All opposed? The motion is carried unanimously. Thank you all very much. Each of you got a handout this morning, so I can tell you this is some of the business today. Just to reiterate, the work that Bob and Mary do on the Shoot Committee, they meet every so often, and that's important communication to with the agencies standing together discussing how they're going to follow them. And just want to be thank you for your service to that committee.
Research.
You do a good thing with work, and I'm happy to have you in those positions. The other thing is the notes that we agreed that we would review third party requests, make a review committee, and see if we're doing it right, see if we're doing it wrong, see what we can do better, see if we need to make any changes to it. So those members will be Sue Baldwin, Bob Henry, Barry Baldwin, Angie Wills, staff support, management support, and then Christy and Harris as their legal leaders. Larry, and then we also had a couple vacancies on the executive committee with people stepping off the commission associate. So for your consideration as a new proposed executive committee, with Neil Anthony being vice chair, Sheila Holman being second vice chair, and I've always believed that the executive committee should represent all parts of the state and our 20 coastal counties. With Phil continuing to represent the southern part of the state and Lamar taking on the middle part. So, if the commission is okay, we'll move forward with that. And so, I'm going to have any questions or whether you know that. I'm going to have to analyze with the question or consensus okay with the thank you. Then I also received, after talking, I'm excited about the science panel. Dr. Lewis, a very dynamic chairman of the UNCW, and talking with her last week, we had there were people that were on the Zoom meeting or WebEx meeting, and I was on my phone answering, trying to get girls' questions about the science for the in-lab area. And then she and I further talked about this science panel in general. And I asked her, did she have any new people that she'd like to put on science panel?
a little bit of our expertise. And she said, yes, she would have. She would like to have that. And she said, she's apologetic. She sent me last night, as a matter of fact. She's recommending Dr. Jim Long from UNCW. Yes, he agrees in environmental engineering, ocean engineering, civil coastal engineering. I worked for nearly a decade in the Geological Survey. Coastal and Marine Science Center is currently an associate professor director of the Coastal Hazards Lab at UNCW. Tommy works with studies in longshore processes, inertial coastal regions, hydrodynamics, waves and currents, and the erosion and creation of beaches and dunes. Sounds like what these things would come up with. And very honest. Practices and understanding these different processes and how they interact with each other. So, the commission is okay with accepting a virtual CD. I'm going to maintain a motion to the General Office of the Science Center.
So moved.
April 26th and 27th at the Dare County Government Center in Manio.
the forest fall there. Nothing else. I'm going to take a motion to adjourn.
I'll make that motion.
So,
I'll say.